Okay, so today I'm in Surrey with Dave Roberts, who we'll describe as a retired seller of jockeys. Thanks very much for giving us some time today, Dave. Right, first of all, I want you to tell us about the 218 bus.
The famous story of the 218 bus. That was my childhood when obviously school and I didn't agree and I didn't go to school very much. And I used to skive off school on two or three afternoons, maybe a fortnight, I'd say, and I'd go and get on the 218 bus from Shepperton to Staines, or wherever the bus was going, whichever meeting was on, Kempton, Sunbury, and go into Sandown was the story which always made me laugh. Was I'd get off the bus at Sandown Park, walk up to the gate, and then I'd wait for a little old lady to come along who adopted me for those 5 minutes and took me through the turnstile, because in those days you had to obviously have an adult to take you in, and off she went and off I went, and I spent the whole day at Sandown watching the racing, and that was probably the start of it. And that would have been from the age of 10 to 12, around that time.
Was it always the same old lady, or was it any
Oh,
random
any old
lady?
lady, no disrespect to old la any lady who looked like she could have an adopted grandchild.
So, I mean, but you must have had an interest in horse racing before you decided to start going. It's quite a daunting place to go to, Sandown, for anybody, let alone as an 8-year-old.
My dad was a very big follower of racing, from a punting point of view. My mum was a very big follower of racing, more from the form, and she used to buy the yearly Time Form annual book, the green book, which she had for many years. I've still got them in the storage somewhere. So it came from my mum and dad totally, and all three brothers, well, myself and my two brothers, we all just always had an interest in horse racing.
Okay, so up until your retirement, was it 2 years ago now?
2 years.
You were the biggest original and most successful seller of jockeys in National Hunt Racing. I mean, what have you been doing yourself since?
Since retirement, I've always been a mad Chelsea fan for my sins, and I've now, where we've moved to Dorking, I've got a season ticket for the local team, Dorking Wanderers, and recently married. We travel a fair bit. We like going to France with my wife. And the big surprise to most people would be is that I am now addicted to the garden and love gardening 12 hours a day if I can get out there.
Now, this must be a big change because you said in the past, I'm referencing Nick Luck's interview with you, you'd sometimes work 20 hours a day when it was the height of the season, spending much of the time on the telephone, starting work at 5:30, etc. I mean, since you've sort of had time to enjoy your time and your money and the garden, have you sort of ever regretted not calling it a day a bit sooner?
When I look back now, I possibly could have retired earlier, but it wasn't the time. I knew that year when I gave up, which obviously 2 years ago, there was kind of a build up to it, and you felt that the mind was perfectly capable of doing the job, and getting up at 5:30 and going to bed at 1 o'clock had was no issue at all. But the body was telling me it was time to, if I wanted to have any form of life going forward, I just had to take stock. And so, difficult decision, but looking back, definitely the right decision.
Yeah, during those years that you're active, you must have had a bit of a wry smile every time you heard a millennial talking about work-life balance.
Never got it. Just never got it. And I've tried to install that in my kids and friends who ask me. And, to me, my dad installed it in me from a very young age, and it was, you work hard, you get the rewards. And I never found it a problem starting at 5:30, and sometimes you may not even sleep for more than an hour.
Now, you've already mentioned that, it was the mind sort of and the body telling you. But I mean, was there sort of a catalyst or a eureka moment when you thought, right, this is time to finish?
I think, if I'm totally honest, and I hope I'm wrong in a way, I think because I've only really ever done jump racing in later, the last 20 years was jump racing solely. And I think jump racing was struggling as a sport a little bit. And there's a lot more, because it used to be very, it was like the fun side of racing, I always felt. And there was lots of good characters and a lot of enjoyment. And I think it just become slightly, it just seemed like the sport was struggling slightly, and there was a lot of people, you know, there was things going on which I didn't really agree with. So there wasn't one particular point. It was mainly the body, but it just felt the right time. You know, I'd had some great years and the best years of my life. And who could work in a hobby and get the rewards that you got, you know, and the pleasure?
I mean, a couple of years later, and this isn't in the script, but, you know, can you elaborate a bit on what you thought was going a bit wrong with it that you didn't like? Has it got worse now since?
I wouldn't say it's got worse since I retired, but I just think it was at a point where the people making decisions were making, from an agent's point of view, you know, there was too much racing to start with. The pressure on the jockeys was too much. You know, you were finding yourself actually where you used to get their rides, and then you'd be a little bit like their go-to, and you'd tell them and try and discuss, you know, if someone was having a bad run, you'd try and talk them through and say, look, you know, your turn will come, keep working hard. And so you're trying to keep their spirits up. But it just become to me that there was too much pressure on jockeys. That's the only side I can really comment on, because that's what the life was about. But as an agent looking after a jockey, I could see the pressures and the stress that was coming on jockeys, and I thought it was too much.
And how many clients did you have at that point?
I'd say 50 plus, including the young jockeys, 56, 7 when I retired, yeah.
So how did you break it to them? Did you get any sort of warning, or was it just a...
Yep, I rung them individually, every single one of them. Probably 3 or 4 weeks before. I went to see the great man AP and told him what I was doing, and you know, his words of advice were always spot on. And you know, it was a difficult decision because you'd been in charge, or not in charge, but you'd been kind of nurturing their careers for so many years. So you know, I wanted to tell them individually and I wanted to speak to them. And at that time I said, you know, if you want to discuss with me which agent I think it would be best for you to go with and any help going forward, I would. And they still ring me now, not so many 2 years on, but there's still jockeys who ring me, and one rung me, I'll say, a month ago, and he, you know, had a chance to get a job. And which way would you go if you were still doing it? And so I'm always there for any advice they want. I still follow it, maybe not to the level I used to, but so it was, I wanted to tell them individually and I did, and I was, in a way, I felt quite good about that.
And working as many hours as you did in the day, I mean, were a lot of these relationships purely remote? Did you ever?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of the jockeys I never met. And you build up a very good rapport with trainers, and a lot of the trainers I never met, because in the early days you'd go racing 4 or 5 days a week. It was just a total way of the way the rides were booked were different. But when the system changed, you couldn't leave the office. Well, if you were doing your job right, you couldn't leave the office. And the funny story, a quick one I'll tell you, was I went down to Lambourne and played golf for the day, and we all went for dinner in the pub, and AP was sat next to me here, and there was Mick Fitz, and all the boys were there. And a jockey, Brian Crowley, I'd never met, but he'd obviously been told that I was coming down, and he'd come down to meet me. And we're all sat at the table, and I knew what he looked like, but clearly he didn't know what I looked like. And he leant across to AP and said, what do you think of that Dave Roberts? He hasn't even turned up, and I've driven all the way to come down and see him. And he was literally sat across me, but he wouldn't know what I looked like probably. So quite funny, you know, but I would say I didn't meet 30% of my jockeys ever.
Did AP put him out of his misery?
I think he took a long time to get over it when he was that embarrassed. Yeah.
Now, I mean, how long would you say you were at that sort of level where you were working so many hours a day you hardly ever left the house?
I mean, that was my choice to work like that. You know, you could go racing. You didn't have to do them hours, but I have got a kind of obsessional temperament. So if I'm going to do something, you're going to put all them hours in. But I would have started probably, I'd have said, to become like that in the Adrian Maguire years, and probably the year when Adrian and Richard Dunwoody were fighting for the title, and it was quite intense, you know, from a point of view of getting the rides and fighting for the rides. So probably from that year onwards, and then having lost the title with Adrian on the last day, there was like a trigger that said to me, you know, I've got to have a champion jockey. And that's probably when it started. And there wasn't an hour of the day I wouldn't have been on the phone and just chasing rides, you know, proper rides. And but the other thing I would say is, though I was doing a lot of jockeys, and I think people question this, if you take a jockey on, you've got to do the same job for every jockey. Just because it was Adrian Maguire or Tony McCoy, whoever, you do the same job for a young jockey who's starting out claiming seven. So if there's a race for jockeys claiming seven, you're ringing for him as well. You're ringing for all those jockeys. So if you're doing that job right, you probably should be on the phone at least 14 hours a day.
So obviously you were earning decent money doing it, but you basically dedicated your entire life for about 20 years nurturing those jockeys and helping their careers while you were sort of basically the hermit in the office.
I think that sums it up quite well. Yeah, I mean, I think I can't remember who it was, someone said that it's like you're living in a bunker, and it was. You got up in the morning, you went, got your first cup of coffee, first of probably 20, and you just went in the office, and from the moment you thought a trainer would be in the yard, you were on the phone, you know, ringing for rides, and you didn't come out until you'd rung every single person. I just used to have lists, and I was known for the highlighters and the coloured pens, but everybody on that list was rung every day. Yeah.
So it must have been a passion for you that you enjoyed.
It was definitely a passion. And like I think touched on earlier, it was your hobby as well. So to be able to work in your hobby and to get that much enjoyment. And there were so many good times, and I'm not just saying the winners at Cheltenham or the Grand National, or, you know, there was good times when a perfect example on a Saturday afternoon at Warwick, like Richard Guest I was doing, and he rode a treble at Warwick, and that gives you so much pleasure that you've got three winners for a jockey. They were all outside rides. I think one of them was 40-1, one of them was 12-1, and you sit back at the end of the day and think, wow, that, you know, you've really done a good job there, you know, and the jockey rings you on the way and says, oh, I can't believe it. And it's a very rewarding job, but obviously the downside is the injuries, and it's, you know, you're looking after their lives, not just their livelihoods.
Yeah, now I'm only going to mention the word once because you don't like it, but what is it about the term agent that you objected to in your career?
I didn't really see myself as an agent. I mean, couple of friends of mine are sporting agents, and I see them as agents, but I never saw myself as an agent. You know, all I really did was book their rides. Just say if I don't know, AP was flying from Fontwell to Worcester, you know, he had someone who did that for him. I wasn't doing that. All I was doing was making sure he was on the best horse I could possibly get him on in each race. And behind the scenes, shall we say, of advice in their life, or, you know, investing in something, you know, I never got involved with that. It was purely booking rides for jockeys. So I saw that to a trainer, that I am a salesman of jockeys to every trainer. And I saw it like that from day one until I retired.
Okay, Dave, can we just go back? I mean, we started a bit topsy-turvy. I've talked about the end and we talked about the middle. Can we just go back to the beginning again? You've already mentioned that you used to go racing on your own as a child. Like I say, for me, that'd be quite daunting as a sort of an eight-year-old. So what, when you got in there, what part of it was it that hooked you?
I mean, I really liked the horses. It was, when I first started going, obviously there was jump and flat racing, but I soon realised it was jump racing I had a real love for. And it was little things, you know, it was, you see the jockeys coming out and then you get to know faces and trainers and you get to know, it was just the whole thing. I mean, I used to walk down to stand by a fence and watch the horses jump the fence and the speed they were going over, you know, it was just very, it just grabbed me, and I just wanted more of it, really.
Did you ever get in any sort of trouble from your dad for sneaking off school and going racing?
Well, in those days he didn't know, but then after a while I think he just gave in and saw that was my career path, and he ended up letting me skive off school and take me racing, and so I think they just gave in with me. Me and school didn't agree, so.
What sort of point in your going racing career did you realise that you could sort of put money on horses and maybe earn a few quid?
I'll be totally honest, I used to have a bet, and the days I did go to school, I would always have my lunch break at, where people had lunch at school. I would come out for lunch, which they thought I was going back to my dad's house type thing, which obviously I wasn't. I used to go round to the Shepperton station and have a bet in the betting shop and get the person in the cafe to put the bet on. So I was probably betting in those days from about 14, I would say.
Okay, so at that point, were you sort of seriously getting involved with the form book?
I used to sit and watch form because my dad, mum and dad were interested. When they were sat at home, especially my mum, she would sit there with the time form annuals, and she would work out all the ratings and add up the weights. And, you know, so I was learning off her because it was so interesting. I thought, what's going on? What are you doing? And say a handicap at Newbury on a Saturday, she'd write the figure of what the time form rate is, and she'd work out the weights and show you how to do it. So from a very young age, you had quite an understanding of what form was, and both my brothers did as well. We were very much, it wasn't just betting, it was actually the understanding of how racing worked.
Yeah, because that was quite an investment today, because I remember buying a time form manual, it was half a week's pay it cost me. So they were quite serious.
Hell, my mum was very serious. That was her one go-to thing every year. And as I say, we've got the annuals in storage, and I'd say she didn't miss many years, one or two, that was it.
So did your mum sort of teach you when you showed an interest?
Oh, definitely, yeah. We would sit there and work out the races, and you'd come up with an answer, and then because in the time frames it might, that you started to read about the horse and say, that this horse in particular loves soft ground. So then you worked out at a young age, you knew what soft ground was, and she'd say to you why, the horse wants soft ground. So you, when it look at the forecast, it's going to rain. And so I think I was before my years with the form book, yeah.
No, it was Barry Beasley, one of my previous interviewees, that put you in the frame for this interview. So thanks, Barry.
thanks, Barry, for agreeing to do it.
He tells me you worked together at the Tote head office. How early in your career was that?
That was very early, yeah. We worked there. I worked under Barry. We were doing the anti-post odds for future races. And again, a good learning curve, because to do that job, you need knowledge of the form book. You have to sit down, you look at a race, and you price the race up. So it was another step in having a good education on the form book. We worked very well together. So I think we got more right than we got wrong. So
was that under Lord White of Weeford?
It was.
So you also learned about percentages, forming a market. So where did you learn how to do that?
I think it's just, again, when I take an interest in something, I am very obsessive with it. And I just knew if I was going to do this job, you had to know how to work out the percentages. And I was very aware of bookmakers' odds because, again, I was betting from quite a young age. And in those days, you used to have fractions. And, when my dad used to take me to the races, and obviously he put my bet on, but say he was back in a horse. I remember a race at Ascot, and he took me on a Wednesday to Royal Ascot. I'm sure it was a Wednesday because he was half day closing. And he was a big fan of Dick Hearn and Joe Mercer. And he wanted to back a horse in the last race called Biskra. I remember this. And whatever he was going to have on, it was 14-1. So I don't know what he had on. And I said to him, why did you do that? And he looked at me, I said, well, it's 100-7. He would have had, say, £7 at 14-1. I said, no, Dad, you have £100 at 7. Because the fraction, you're getting better value. And it was, so that was from a very early age. So I'd say that was 14, 15, maybe, 14 even.
Right, I'm going to put you on the spot because I ask everybody that's a good odds compiler.
Right.
The same question. And so far, I've yet to have an answer.
Okay.
How'd you do it?
How do you odds compile? You read
where do you start
a race?
With a race.
Yeah.
You're looking at a race, there it is, there are the runners. Tell me how you do it.
In my day, what I would have done, say a six horse race, you would find your favourite. So just say if we were going to use, you know, a 2 mile chase, you'd find your favourite and then you'd work out, to me, how I did it, you'd work out what possibilities you've got of getting that favourite beat. So if you don't fancy or don't give much chance to four of the others, the odds are going to be shorter. You might have one danger. So you centre around the horses you think can win the race. So then you know, if there's only two out of six can win, and you originally thought it might be a 6-4 chance, it's probably going to be an even money chance. Then you've got your danger, and you make the other four bigger prices.
Would you work to 100% then add a bit of profit margin? Or
2% every horse it was, and then over 10. So a 10-horse race was 120%. And if it was a 13-horse race, you add on one for everyone after that. So it would be a 13-horse race would be 123%.
Okay. So you were working doing the anti-post at the tote.
Tote.
Any terrible ricks there where somebody's tucked you right up?
Well, I carried on doing that as well for Marshall Racing. But my anti-post at the tote was really under Barry. So if he made a rick, he can take the blame for it. So I did it at Marshall Racing on my own. And again, I'd like to think we got more right than wrong, but you can't be right all the time. And yeah, we made a very big rick one day. I think it was a Greenall Whitley back in the day. And 14ers Express, Arthur Stevenson, Chris Grant. I just got it in my head, this horse couldn't win. Hate the ground. You know, raining all morning was the forecast, so I was quite comfortable. But when we opened up and all the lines lit up and everybody, as they say, every man and his dog wanted to be on it, you start to doubt yourself and you look back in the form and think, have I missed something? And the horse duly obliged, so I got that wrong, yeah.
Tell us a bit more about Marshall Bookmakers. I'm told based in the West End, so that sounds like quite a...
Yeah, that was John Marshall. I'm still friendly with him. And that was a new bookmakers at the time. Had horses. Did very well, you know. But it didn't last, just, I think, through the backers moved away. And it's hard to break through against the big boys, really. You've got Ladbrokes, Hills, Corals. You're never really going to break through against them. So I think they stepped back humbly, shall we say.
Okay, and it was working as a, you know, in a bookmaking career, something that you sort of thought about seriously, or was that just a toe in the door to racing?
I would never really have gone down that route of bookmaking, purely because any connection I had with the bookmakers was more anti-post, making the odds. Because the side of bookmaking I enjoyed more was making the odds, which is, again, really based on the form book. It's that side of the interest for me, because you're looking at the horses. Even though you're making odds, you're still judging a horse or gauging the chances of a horse. And then you watch all the races and you're trying to spot, say, a future winner and, you know, a trainer that's quite shrewd, and you keep an eye on that horse. So I never really had an interest in going into the bookmaking side of things, no.
Okay, just for example, like Marshall Bookmakers, would they have had Barney Curley type characters on their books that they would still lay that were a great lead for you? Would you sort of follow people in?
You used to have, because Marshall Racing were quite inventive in a sense, they would bet on races that not everybody would. They would take a chance and bet. I think the greatest one was, not being a flat race, I'm not sure. Was it called the Lockinge or something? Anyway, but Horage, Matt McCormack, was odds on favourite, had won so many races on the bounce. And we just took the view that the win had to come to an end at some time. So we advertised in those days, it probably was the Sporting Life actually, we advertised, for argument's sake, 11-8 on the morning of the race. And the Sporting Life predicted odds was 4-6. So you can imagine everything lit up. But in that race, a couple of days before, one of the other owners of a horse had rung to speak to me and say, you know, they'd like to back their horse in this race, what's we couldn't. So you knew there was a chance of the horse getting beat. So you used to get good leads. You know, there was little bits of information, but not many, but there was some good ones, yeah.
And I'm told that you were good enough at form to produce a card for Racecourse Bookmakers. Now, they'd have been quite unforgiving as you got it wrong many times.
I used to, when I came out of the bookmaking or doing the odds for the bookmakers, I wanted to work for myself and have a go on my own. And I had no idea what job that was going to be, if I'm honest. So I started off actually by writing to racecourses, producing a form like an analysis at the bottom of the horse on the race card. But like anything, when you start, there was not much takers. There was not, not much interest. And then suddenly Bath Racecourse rung me and said, "We're interested. Can you send a few like trial runs?" You know, and they took me on and did that. And I did Bath, and I had a another company came to me and said they just wanted to have. None of this was kind of like a tipping service. It was more information. And they wanted to have a breakdown on form for races, like anti-post races, you know. So they had that in front of them. And then I got approached by two or three racecourse bookmakers to give them a form guide. But it wasn't, again, they weren't asking me to say, "Do you think this will win or do you think this will lose?" It was more, this horse wants soft ground, and if it starts off good to firm and the 6 hours of rain forecast, so they had more knowledge maybe than the others. So I did that for a little while, but it didn't last long. But it was a kind of an avenue into getting something working for yourself.
And how serious were you punting in those days?
I had my moments of punting. I'd like to say before I became an agent. But I had I was manager of horses for 2 years, 18 months, 2 years. And they were based with a very shrewd trainer. And so there were moments that I had a bet, but I've never been, or even from young days, I was never someone who'd bet very often. But when I did think I'd found a race where a horse could win, I'm more likely to put more money on in one go than, say, go to the races and bet every day. You know, I used to go racing for weeks on end and never have a bet. It wasn't about the betting, but I was always keeping my eyes open for something with a future possibility, shall we say.
And finally, for this part, did professional punting ever come into your head?
I think once you've had a bet and been successful, wouldn't say I was mega successful, but I probably won more than I lost. It does cross your mind because you think, what would I be like if I was given, if that was the future? But I've never done it. Probably the right choice, but it did cross my mind, yeah.
You think you could have?
70-30, yes.
Okay, Dave, you mentioned before I tried to talk you into being a professional punter that you were a racing manager. Tell us a little bit about what that entailed and how you got into it.
It was the one of the owners of Marshall Racing had horses, and as I say, they closed the company down, and they still had race horses in England. And he asked me if I would manage the horses, basically represent him as the owner. He only had six or seven left by then, and they were with Jeff Lewis mainly in Epsom. There was one with Oliver Sherwood, funny enough, over jumps, which wasn't very good. Did win a race, but not very good. But so they were mainly based with Jeff Lewis. And the job was, it was like you were the owner. You'd go and see Jeff. You'd plan where they were going to run. You'd go and represent him as the owner. And all he wanted me to do was to say to him, for example, sake, Solo Style is running on Saturday at this time, and he'll follow it from, I think he was in America most of the time, and he'd still follow it and watch the race. Or if he wanted to have a bet, he'd say, "What chance do you think it's got?" And then I'd tell him, this very good chance, you've got this to beat and what to beat, and then left it with him. So it was a idyllic job. I mean, you were really an owner of six horses and getting paid to do it and paid your expenses and everything. So it was a little bit of a job which I shouldn't think many people get the chance to do, but it built up a lot of connections for me with the Jeff Lewis and trainers and jockeys, you know, so it was a good, probably a good stepping stone, even though I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, you met, well, trainer Jeff Lewis at that time, but previously Mill Reeves Derby winning jockey. And he gave you the idea to become a jockey's, a seller of jockeys. They didn't exist in his day. Why did he think it'd be a good idea?
Well, the story went that, the person I was managing for decided to sell the horses and that was the end of everything there. So there was no job left, which was fine. I knew that would happen at some stage. So by then I'd built up quite a good relationship with Jeff and Nolene. And he said to me, why don't you be an agent? And I said, what's an agent do? And he said, well, you know, just ring up a trainer, get some rides. And I thought, well, I've never heard of it. And I'm sure there was the odd, say, wife of a jockey or father, daughter, whichever, might have helped get a ride, but there was no such thing as agents at the time. And me being me, I thought, well, yeah, give it a go. So he said the first person was Jason Swift, which I think was his godson, maybe something. There was a connection with Brian Swift and Jason Swift. And so I started ringing up and getting rides for Jason Swift, and he was getting rides everywhere because no one was ringing. And if you rung a trainer and said, have you got a jockey for the apprentice race at Doncaster? Oh, who are you ringing for? And then you tended to get rides. And he lived with Dean Gallagher, who then became my first jump jockey. And Dean Gallagher was very pally with Richard Guest. And then that was the third jockey. And Richard Guest worked for Toby Baldwin, and the rest is history.
So why do you think it had never been done before? And what sort of year are we talking about?
Well, we'd be talking late 80s. Yeah, late 80s. Solo Star won at Nottingham in 86, 88. Yeah, 89, 88, 89. I don't know, is the honest answer. I don't know. I just think it's something no one had thought of. And Jeff was so good to me over the years. And, you know, I learned so much from him, and privileged to be in his company with his... Because obviously I was looking after the horses, so he probably saw me as the owner, but you learn a lot from him, a very wise man. And he just, I think he wanted me to have a job and keep in racing. But I don't honestly know why there wasn't, if that is the truth.
Okay, and I don't want to ask you about actual figures and things like that, but I mean, what was the bare bones of it? Did you sort of earn from each riding fee and a bit of prize money, or how did you earn a living from it?
From day one, and it never changed from the start to the day I retired, I would charge 10% of whatever they earned on the race course. Again, not to do with sponsorship or if there was ever a bonus or an incentive, you know, or retainer fee. There was none of that. It was just 10% straight down the line. And I think most agents have stuck with that over the years.
And did you get involved with trying to get them extra, like sponsorships? And
no. Never. They might ask my advice, would you, you know, be sponsored by this person, or we've got two people who want to sponsor us, would you have a preference? But I wouldn't go looking for the sponsorship, no.
Right, and so I was going to ask, did it take a while to build up, but it seems like it snowballed quite quickly.
It started quite quickly, just because there was no one else there. So I think if you were a jockey, so I did do flat jockeys to start with, because again, you've got to get going and you're running a new business. So I go right back to Gypsy Mackay, Tyrone Williams, Andrew Tucker. But they were ringing me, I think, just because they thought that, well, if we've got someone else trying, because in those days, jockeys still rung for themselves. Because I would say, using Tyrone Williams, for example, he would get rides. I mean, if there was a 9-race card, he'd have a ride in every race. He must have been on the phone himself as well as me. And between us, you know, we got a lot of rides. And he'd just ring me and say, well, just by the way, I'm on this in the 7:30, so leave that race out, see what you can get in the others. And but I think it was just there was no one else ringing round for rides. And I think you'd started... I like to think the job, especially as it develops over the years, you were taking... a bit of the pressure off the trainers. They got enough to do with the horses to worry about who's going to ride, you know, the horse if they've not got a stable jockey. So I did feel once you built up the rapport with trainers, they trust you a little bit. If you say, well, I've got Tyrone Williams, I've got ABC, you know, they'll probably take one of them. So you were also helping them in their time, where they were putting their time more valuable to them, as opposed to chasing around, you know, trying to get hold of a jockey.
In the early days, there's still quite a few 10% needed to get a living, you know, to get a decent race to begin with.
Yeah, it was, you know, no disrespect to the lads I was doing, but they weren't top five, top 10 jockeys. You know, we started in the at the bottom and worked up, but jockeys, you know, I used to say to them jockeys, using Tyrone as a perfect example, just it sticks in my mind. I remember saying to him one day, he said, like, you know, you've just got to work hard. And he said, everybody tells me you're putting my name forward. I said, well, that's what you're paying me to do. I'm only doing a job. You know, it's not rocket science. If you haven't got a ride in the race, I'm going to ring up and get you one. And that's how it sort of worked, and it snowballed.
Now, you said the rest is history, but for people that may not know, your big break, and some may say Tony's big break as well, was when Toby Balding put you onto young AP McCoy.
Well, Toby Balding would be, and Jeff Lewis would be the two, but Toby Balding would be obviously the man I own most, because he also introduced me to Adrian Maguire, which still, without a shadow of doubt, without being biased, you know, the greatest jump jockey, never to be champion jockey. But Toby introduced me to Adrian Maguire, Barry Fenton, another great jockey. Richard Guest rode for him. You know, there wasn't a jockey that Toby asked me to take on who wasn't a very good jockey. And of course, as you say, then that day that he asked me to take on the great man, and that's the word I always use, even to this day, when people ask, I say the rest is history. It's just look at the records, it speaks for itself.
And how difficult was it to still give your other clients the attention they deserved when you had someone like AP on your books?
I mean, like I said earlier, if I was going to take jockeys on, say when I took AP on, I would have said I may have had 35 to 40 jockeys already. That's a guess, but I'd say mid-30s potentially. From that day on, you still get other jockeys who want to come on your books. And I always took the view that if you were going to take a jockey on, you had to do the same job for them, not just, say, AP or Mick Fitz or Norman Williamson, Adrian Maguire. It's you have to put the same time into a jockey, else you shouldn't take him on, because I think that's a bit like you're just taking money for old rope, really. And that probably, again, snowballs into the sense that's why you're doing 14, 16, 18-hour days, because you've got to get through the workload to keep up with doing all those jockeys.
Right, now, I was going to make a list of your jockeys, but being a bit lazy, it's a lot easier just to, you know, mention the ones that you didn't get. So can you give us just a handful of some of your most memorable clients, maybe not the most obvious ones, and why?
I think this is going to sound a bit corny maybe, but every jockey really, as I say, because if you take a jockey on, you've got to believe that jockey's going to bring you success. Because the aim of being a salesman of jockeys is, if a jockey's doing well, they're easier to sell. If a jockey's struggling, you know, a trainer might think, well, you know, is he riding as well as he was? He's not riding many winners. So obviously, the more winners you can get your jockeys, that brings an easier approach for you. Because if you ring a trainer, you know, they're going to say, oh yeah, I saw him ride a winner the other day, we'll use him. So my jockeys are endless. I've been so lucky to deal with what I would consider some of the best jockeys that have ever ridden. From a point of view of not the obvious, like I mentioned, the Richard Guest treble. I mean, I had a lot of pleasure in making young jockeys champion conditional jockeys. That was a real pleasure. But there was also a series called the Hands and Heels series, which was for jockeys who hadn't ridden 10 winners. And that's really back to grassroots, as I would call it. So a young jockey starting out, they might have ridden one winner, no winners, and we won that 7 years on the bounce. And that would be then that's when you sit back at night and think, you've done a good job there. Yeah, that's worked out well. So there's not particular names, because there's so many of them. I someone's asked me before and said, how many jockeys did you do over the years? And I'd be horrified to know, because it's probably guessing 400. That's a guess, but so there's no particular names. But from a point of view of satisfaction and achievement, the little ones are as just as important as the big ones.
This is something I'm going to just throw at you. It wasn't in the list of questions, but do you think these days it's harder for jockeys? Because I'm just thinking about the minute they get off the horse, there's a microphone in front of their faces these days, and they've got to be able to talk. And you know, it was that something that didn't really happen much in your day? And is it, was it something that was ever sort of tutored?
It never happened. Well, very rarely did it happen, especially in the early days. Towards the end, it did. I can see why they do it, and I can see why it's good to have that. Not so sure it's a good idea. I think that's a lot of pressure on someone to be able... It's great if you win, but I sometimes watch certain people interview jockeys on the beaten horses, and I think, really? You know, if you take my other love, if... especially the way they're playing at the moment. If you asked 10 Chelsea players the other night when they walked off the pitch at Arsenal, how was that for you? I think you might get a pretty blunt answer. So I think it's quite... I'm not a big fan of that. I think I can see why, but I'm not a big fan.
Okay, now at your peak, you've had over 50 jockeys on your books, spent 20 hours a day on the phone. Where did you find the time to sort of study the form and stuff? Did you have sort of help?
No, I always did it myself. When I used to get up, the first phone call used to be about 7 o'clock in the morning. Some trainers you knew were about fractionally earlier, but not many. So you wouldn't probably ring before seven. So say 5:30 to 7 o'clock was studying the form. In those days, it was 24-hour decks. So you would be looking at the cards and you'd be spotting. You know, you needed to have a list in front of you who you were going to ring first. There was like an order of ringing. So if there was Fontwell on, you'd looked at the six races and you'd narrowed down, going back to knowing the form, you'd narrowed down the first two or three of them betting and you'd concentrate on them first, because the idea is to get on winners. Anybody can get you on a horse, but if it's not going to win, it's not that important. You know, you get them later on. Yeah. So you'd spend a good hour and a half in the morning, and then when the trainers went racing, you'd be flat out on the phone, say, till 12:30. And then the afternoon when the racing was on, you'd watch the racing and you'd be reading the form at the same time and with your eyes. I did a lot of it with... I mean, there wasn't a race I didn't watch. And a lot of it I went with my eye, and you'd make an opinion of a horse. You know, if a horse looked like he was dodging it a bit, you know. So it was mainly through the eyes, yeah.
Okay, Dave. No, Dave, you must have been, without any question of a doubt, the best informed person in the game at the height of your selling jockey's career. Were you betting?
No, definitely not.
Is that just a choice that you made? Because there's no rules about it.
I made the choice. I don't think there was rules. I mean, I won't mention names, but I know of one agent who definitely was betting in my era. But I took the view from a very early age a salesman, shall we say, that if I was going to get the trust of trainers and owners, jockeys as well, everybody, you know, I couldn't be seen to be betting, because you were in a privileged position. You did get told things which maybe not everybody would, but I took the view it wouldn't be professional. I wouldn't be able to build up rapport with trainers, and I honestly think by taking that decision, that allowed me to have some very strong and trusted relationships with some of the top trainers and owners. And looking back now, people say to me, said, yeah, but you must have had a bet, you must have known this, you must have known that. Doesn't matter what you knew, there's still no guarantees. But I honestly can put my hands up and say no, I didn't. And you know, as I say, I think that was a very good decision to have the longevity of my career, having that trust from, say, the likes of Nicky Henderson and David Nicholson and people like that.
When you've got jockeys on your books as successful as AP or Richard Johnson, would it be a case of then people were pestering you, or did was it a case of you said, "I'll call you, don't call me"? What, how did it work then?
I think obviously there'd be a lot of people who would ring up for those for rides, and no disrespect to the younger lads, but they're more likely to ring for AP or Richard Johnson, especially when there was other agents, because then they kind of waited for the agent to come to them. But I think the longer the time went on, you had to be on the phone more, because I think trainers then got used to thinking, well, we don't need to ring anybody because A, B or C will ring us and then we can pick a jockey. So I would say it was probably at the end. At the start, it would have been 50-50. At the end, it was more 80-20, the agent ringing the trainer and then the trainer giving you an answer.
Now, we've heard stories about Lester Piggott back in the day negotiating various benefits for his services. I mean, was there ever like a bidding war for an enhanced fee or a bigger share of the prize money for your top jocks?
I can honestly say, to my knowledge, I mean, they might have been approached directly, but there was very few occasions that I was approached as the agent, salesman, to get one of my jockeys to ride a horse and be offered extra incentives or extra amounts. It did happen, but none of my jockeys ever took that up. So I'd say it was quite rare, but there was the odd occasion it would happen.
Okay, now how much would you say the things changed the way you did them over your career?
Greatly, because when I started, I was the only agent, salesman, whatever we're going to call me. There wasn't much competition to start with, and probably for a few years there wasn't. So Jeff had dropped on a real niche that was untouched, I would nearly say the word was. But obviously then there became more agents and more people saw that was a good avenue to go in. So it came more competitive year on year. I liked it the old way where you'd ring up, you know, you used to get the runners in the Sporting Life in the morning and you'd ring up and you get the ride. And it became, when it became very all done on a computer and me being a bit old fashioned, that was a bit of a culture shock, you know, having to do it all on the computer. So I'd say now, when I retired, should we use that, there was a lot more people just putting jockeys on horses, taking them off. The moral had gone out a bit where you were trying to help, it became more of a battlefield.
Did you ever take on jockeys that you didn't particularly like? Did you have to sort of hold your nose and just do business anyway, or did you pick and choose?
Because I didn't really get to meet them, I didn't necessarily know what they were going to be like. So if I ever got approached by a jockey, I would speak to my senior jockeys, most of them, and say, have you got any reason why I shouldn't take on, you know, Mr. X? And if there was an issue or they just thought, well, we'd rather you don't, then I wouldn't take them on. But I would say most of my jockeys I had a good understanding with, and probably I could think of a handful who were pretty hard work, but I still think I had a good relationship with them, but it was a different relationship. You knew they were hard work.
Okay, so what, this is probably a hard one, but what part of your career are you most proud of?
What part of my career is most proud of? Well, I always judge myself, and again, I touched on this earlier, I know everybody wants to ride a winner at Cheltenham, I know everybody wants to win the Grand National, and even if you look at AP and say everybody wants to be champion jockey, my proudest moment for me would be the number of winners that AP rode, just because I think I always base my career on numbers, not necessarily the Grand National, because it's a bit like a football season, it's over 38 games. So when you're doing a championship or a season, it's over whatever time of year we're talking about, 12 months, 10 months, or when there was the summer break. And that's how I judged it. So I think it was the number of winners he ended up with, and you know, over a period of time, I that will never be beaten. Even when I'm long and gone and buried in the ground, that will never be beaten. It's impossible to beat that total.
Impossible because you never get somebody as driven as Tony McCoy?
I don't think you'll ever see another jockey with the mentality of AP, and I don't think you'll see another jockey who has the mentality and the desire to win and the talent that goes with it. And I just think it's impossible for anybody to get near that figure. And that's no disrespect to anybody in the future when I'm long and gone.
Well, it sounds to me like you and AP were a good match because obviously you were going over and above with a 20-hour... You know, nobody works 20 hours a day on a regular basis for a period of time. So going back to the topsy-turvy nature of this interview, so going right back to the beginning again, you said that your father was keen to drive home a hard work ethic for you and your brothers. Why do you think he was so determined to do that? And did that set you in good stead?
Definitely. I mean, I've said this on record before. My dad ran a off licence, a little village off licence, and he had us working in the shop, whether it was taking the empties out, stocking the shelves from a very young age. And we were taught, or I was taught by him, and I live by it to this day, that, as I said earlier, you know, if you work hard, you'll get the rewards. And I've carried that with me all my life, and I will, even though I'm retired, whatever I do now, I still carry it with me. If I've put 20 seeds in the garden and 19 come up, I want to know why the other one hasn't.
And is that something that you've replicated with your own kids?
Yes, I've tried to install that in my kids, and I think they've definitely taken it on board. And I also, you know, people who ask about your career and why do you think it was so successful, I try and install that in them, that, you know, that's my motto in life. If you work hard, not necessarily straight away, and it might be over a period of time, but you will get the rewards.
Now, working as you were dedicated to the job for so many years, you assume with all those jockeys you're earning yourself, you know, a nice wage, that sort of thing. But in reality, you had 20 years where you were earning, but you couldn't really afford to enjoy it, have the time to enjoy it. So was the work enjoyment enough, even though you couldn't go on holidays to Barbados for 2 weeks and that sort of thing?
I think you get into I found myself in a position where, and I go back to, you got to remember, it was my hobby as well. So I was working in what was my hobby and privileged to be working with some of the best jockeys. I mean, I could have took another path in racing, which might have ended up working, say, with a bookmaker, for example. And I'd have been watching from afar with the likes of Norman Williamson and Adrian Maguire, you know, riding. And, you know, you were lucky to be involved really at the crux of their careers. And I used to pinch myself at times and sit back and think, you know, wow, you know, how have I got here, you know?
So now that you are retired, obviously being that immersed in it for so long, how much are you still paying attention to it all?
I do follow it, not as much, because I told myself that if I'm going to step back, I need to step back. So the first year I made a point of not, say, stepping back totally, but I did take a proper step back, because otherwise I might as well have carried on and doing what I was doing. And now I find myself looking a little bit more like Harry Cobden and Sean Bowen are both my jockeys of the day, and one of them will be champion jockey, so I've been following that. So I'm watching it more now, but would I go back? You never know.
Do you still get your head in the form book?
I like to do, it's strange because it's, as you're saying about full circle, it's quite strange. It's like, I like to pick a race out and then have a study up and see what I come up with and then look at the result or watch the race. And I think I could get back into the form side of it quite quickly, yeah.
So should the bookmakers be alerted to a D. Roberts opening an account for a free £25 bet?
In my day, you could open your name in someone else's, open an account in someone else's name.
Yeah, maybe this won't get paid.
No, I don't think. I don't think the betting days are coming back, no. I've been three times with my brother recently and not had one bet, so that probably says it all.
Okay, now finally, Dave, I read or watched, I've done a lot of sort of Googling and stuff. I'm not sure where I got it. Now, Nick Luck probably, that you put your son off following in your footsteps. Now, was he seriously interested, and have you still put him off?
I told him, he asked me from a young age and said, you know, could I carry on? Could I do the job? And it was for no other reason apart from I wouldn't want him to have the life I had. It's you sacrifice a lot. I mean, I loved it. It wasn't his passion. It was my passion. He obviously followed it because of the job his dad was doing. But I wouldn't have wanted him to do that job because I know he wouldn't, if he'd have done it for 23 years, he wouldn't have had a life for 23 years. Cause it's very, and there's other agents who've started now who've rung me for advice when they think of setting up. And I've said to them, you know, if you're going to work hard, you'll do well and you'll get the rewards. But if you've got a social life, forget it, because you won't have a social life.
And that was going to be my last question. What would your advice be to anyone that fancies sort of muscling in and emulating your career? Could you do it and work 10 hours a day and be successful?
It's what you gauge as success. So you could probably make a living, you could probably get good results. But if you were going to follow my mindset, you basically have got to, I think the perfect situation for a jockey's agent would be for a single man who loves horse racing, has no other hobbies, and loves watching racing and being involved with racing 18 hours a day. If you've got a social life, if you've got a wife, if you've got a family, or if you've got another interest, forget it. If you're going to do the job like Dave Roberts did the job.
Brilliant. Well, Dave Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.